Welcome to Enclave on Air. I'm your host today, Jax DiEugenio. In today's episode, supported by Real Chemistry, we had the pleasure of speaking with Martin Dietrich, MD. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Dietrich discussed key efficacy findings from the 18-month follow-up of the Phase 2 VISION trial, which evaluated the efficacy of tepotinib in patients with non-small cell lung cancer. Additionally, Dr. Dietrich emphasized important safety considerations, particularly the management of on-target adverse effects such as edema. He also discussed strategies for addressing treatment-related adverse events such as hyperalbuminemia, hyponatremia, and kidney function abnormalities, and highlighted the importance of careful monitoring to make dose adjustments as necessary. What were some key efficacy findings from the 18-month follow-up analysis of the VISION trial?
Yeah, so the multi-cohort study, the VISION trial, that evaluated the efficacy of tepotinib in a number of MET-altered non-small cell lung cancer backgrounds was a two-cohort study that we're actually discussing. One is cohort A that had the original data for which we have almost 3 years follow-up. And when we saw data, we got a second follow-up cohort for this, very similar in the patient enrolled in cohort C with 18 months follow-up. And what we're seeing is a very confirmatory result. We had very good results in cohort A. The response rates were between 50 and 60%. The durability of these responses around a year and a half. So a tremendous amount of impact in this otherwise difficult to treat patient population. Cohort C, obviously lacking this longer follow-up, but showing very similar results. So we have a set of deep responses with durable responses that have been confirmed in this treatment subset.
What safety considerations with tepotinib were important to note within this trial?
So there were a number of safety considerations that are of importance. We have very good efficacy, so the indication of why we're giving this drug is very clear. This is in line with targeted therapy expectations in terms of efficacy. Now, in terms of side effects, we're seeing a very distinct pattern of side effects. As you know, the exon 14 skipping mutations in the MET gene leads to a decreased turnover and therefore an overaccumulation of receptor at the cell, but we really don't have a distinct target structure. So we are blocking essentially the oncogenic MET exon 14 skipping receptor with the same stringency as we target the MET wild type receptor. And by understanding the wild type receptor's function in the body, we really can understand the side effect profile of the drug very well. It's really across the board on target effect and its downstream impact on the body. The most important one is to understand that MET is involved in controlling the integrity of the vasculature in the capillary bed, and edema is by far the most common side effect. 81% of patients did experience some degree of edema. In my experience, that holds up. We see edema across the patient population exposed to varying degrees. It's very hard to predict what patients are experiencing. A secondary effect of this is loss of protein, hypoalbuminemia. We see decreased oncotic pressure and loss of sodium, so resulting hyponatremia. And in severe cases, when the vasculature is intravascularly depleted, we see decreased perfusion pressure in the kidney, decreased kidney function, retention of potassium, and increase in creatinine as a connected side effect profile. The second side effect that we have to be aware of, and this is something that we see with all small molecules, is liver function test abnormalities. So it's very important to understand that these side effects are not necessarily side effects, but they are on-target side effects in the MET receptor, unfortunately, and without an ability to discern this. And we see this actually in a very similar way to c-MET antibodies as well. So if you target c-MET, edema is almost inevitable. That brings us to the management for this side effect. And it's very clear that we're seeing leakage without impairment of cardiac function. So it's different from edema that we would see with heart failure related to anthracyclines or anti-HER2 target therapy, but it's truly a capillary leak syndrome in its presentation. And we don't really have very good strategies for the severe cases. For the mild cases, we use limb elevation, we use a fluid control strategy with diuretics and fluid restrictions and compression stockings if it is focal, but they can occur in virtually any compartment of the body. The most effective intervention for the more severe cases, in my experience, is dose adjustment. As you know, the dosing is in the market with two 225 milligram tablets once daily. And what we would do, and because these side effects occur relatively quickly, it's an on-target effect, we expect it within the first 1 to 2 weeks, we peel back from two pills to one pill. Typically, we give a patient a little bit of a break in between those dose adjustments. So about a week typically leads to normalization of this fluid accumulation, and we start at lower dose. And what the VISION trial showed, and this is true for cohort A and cohort C, is that we really didn't appreciate a pattern of impaired efficacy with the dose adjustment. And this extended into patients that had brain metastases at baseline. It's always a subset that we worry particularly about with dose adjustments. Do we get the same amount of drug past the blood-brain barrier? And it does seem to be the case.
With that in mind, how did the safety profile of this drug impact the quality of life data that we're seeing?
Well, the quality of life data was very reflective of the underlying cancer control. I think that's an important understanding. If we have controlled cancer, the patients do and feel better. And clearly, with this degree of efficacy impact, you see quality of life. That certainly is confirmatory of using this drug. We see good control. But I think the particularly interesting compartment here is the brain metastases. We have response rates, and this is obviously not stratified for brain metastases up front, but it's very clear that the responses of brain metastases are just about the same what we would expect from the extracranial responses in the ITT population. So this is a highly brain active agent and that preserves quality of life. And that's actually one of the most favorable situations. We also see stabilization of bone metastases, which is very important because it is sort of a surrogate marker of skeletal and musculoskeletal pain. So we see stabilization there as well. So across the board, this is a therapy that has high efficacy and a stability of quality of life related to cancer control, and with particular interest for bone and brain metastases.
Were there any patients that tended to have sort of a worse baseline quality of life than others, sort of looking between these different types of metastases?
I think overall, obviously, the more disseminated brain metastases and bone metastases are, the worse the quality of life starting point is. I think I want to look at this from a standpoint also from utility of the drug. We had patients here that were enrolled with an untreated first-line setting and in a later-line setting. And we do have an appreciation that the patients enrolled later on probably were more affected by their cancers. And while this was not a study to directly answer the question of line usage for the drug, it was very clear that the patients had more durable responses and oftentimes sort of a better starting point for treatment. And we also want to appreciate that we lose about a quarter of patients between first and second line. So when you have a therapy here where we really don't have any other specific therapy approved in treatment that we offer, this is a first and they were almost by definition best in class therapy up front.
And lastly here, is there anything that you'd like to add about your clinical experience? I know that you mentioned sort of dose adjustments and things of the like, but what advice would you really give to clinicians hoping to prescribe this medication?
So I think the most important step is to identify these mutations and acknowledge and appreciate their impact. MET has gotten an incredibly complex marker. We see amplification, we see overexpression. We also see the MET exon 14 skipping mutation. And MET exon 14 skipping mutation is a mutually exclusive oncogenic driver. And if you look at the NCCN guidelines and our practice experience, very concordant here, and this is a therapy in its impact that is to be preferred in the clinical setting. Now, it's a receptor that will grow only in its reach. This is an active development in a number of settings in non-small cell lung cancer, in combination with osimertinib upon progression through escape with MET overexpression or amplification. We do see this already, and this is part of the NCCN guidelines, that the MET amplified cancers up front have an NCCN guideline support for tepotinib in the stream. It's not yet approved by the FDA, but we certainly can access this for patients. And we see it in all histologies, including squamous cell carcinoma. So my firm recommendation here would be to look at liquid and tissue biopsy up front to identify these tumors. So that would be the segue to identify a patient and match a patient to the right targeted therapy up front. The second step is the familiarity with the side effects. And I think that's very important. Again, if you understand the MET impact on the vasculature, you really have a good grasp on the patient experience side. Obviously, liver function test is something we monitor for patients, but mostly not experienced by the patients. But all the downstream effects on the vasculature, intravascular depletion, electrolyte shifts, hyperalbuminemia, they're all connected. And it's very similar levels. So edema and hyperalbuminemia have the same level of percentage presentation. So it's very important to very early on as an on-target effect, monitor the patients very closely. When a patient starts therapy, a follow-up phone call should start within 7 to 10 days after treatment initiation. Or if a patient has new symptoms of swelling in hands, feet, other parts of the body. It's very important. It can occur anywhere. You have vasculature anywhere, so swelling and edema can occur anywhere. And then manage this appropriately with dose adjustments. It's very convenient. The patient really doesn't have to do anything else but to report this. We like to typically document it with pictures, but oftentimes patients are able to document this on their phones and provide it. So oftentimes they don't even have to come in for these follow-up phone calls. And then once we find the right dose, and in about a third of patients, we adjust to 225 milligrams, the patients are actually able to tolerate the therapy well and are able to take the full benefit of treatment. In my experience, if you let edema go too long, the reabsorption of the fluid does take quite a bit longer. The interruption is necessary to come back to baseline quite a bit more frequent. So we really want to have an early intervention for edema as the main side effect for treatment.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Enclave on Air, supported by Real Chemistry. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On X, follow us at Enclave. On Facebook, give us a like at Enclave and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of Enclave on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, feel free to rate us. Thank you again for listening to Enclave on Air.